folks, before we get to our next episode, I wanted to ask if you've ever considered leaving a tip for Word Balloon in the past and didn't, I could really use your help this month. July is always an expensive month with San Diego Comic-Con, but it's always provided dividends down the road. When it comes to making new creator connections for future Word Balloon episodes, San Diego has always been a big boost to the podcast. So this month in particular, if you can swing a couple dollars, do me a favor. Go to the front page of wordballoon.com, hit the donate button, and give what you can. Check out our front page of Word Balloon, and you'll see the contribution drop box there, right under the symbol for the League of Word Balloon listeners. As always, thank you for your support and for listening. Now, on to the show. In association with iFanboy, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. John Suntress here, and today we've got a great double feature for you. Chris Roberson and Allison Baker of Monkey Brain Press. They have entered the comics realm as digital publishers with their Monkey Brain comics line. You know Chris, of course, from his great work, not only as a sci-fi novelist, but on such vertical titles as Fable Cinderella, and of course his wonderful run on Superman. He did that crossover with the Legion of Superheroes and Star Trek for IDW, and now he and Allison are in charge of this great new digital initiative. We talk about the five titles that debuted on the 4th of July, their plans for the present and future with Monkey Brain Comics, and hint at a few future projects along the way. Then we speak with documentarians Larry Maslon and Michael Cantor. They are working on a documentary for PBS called Never Ending Story. It's going to debut in 2013, and it's going to take a look at the history of comics. We've caught them in mid-production, so they're still shaping this project. And we get a great chance to talk to the guys as they are gathering interviews. They've done a great job of getting Golden Age people and contemporary people as well. And it's a great conversation about comics history, what they've uncovered so far. And we get kind of an idea of where the documentary's direction is going once it does come out next year. So it'll be a great chance to talk to Larry and Michael and Chris and Allison on today's Word Balloon. It's all brought to you today by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. Great deals going on at InStockTrades.com. The deal of the week is Secret Warriors. 52% off the hardcover omnibus. Just $48 at InStockTrades.com. Also, for the month, 45% off all IDW comics. Indeed, a massive DC comic sale, select trade paperbacks going on. Just 60% off while stock lasts at InStockTrades.com. And the DC archive titles, just 50% off. You can pick up Batman Earth 1 from Gary Frank and Jeff Johns, 40% off, just $13.79. The classic Wonder Woman story, The 12 Labors, 40% off, just $8.99. And Suicide Squad, Volume 1 of The New 52. You can pick that up for, again, $8.99 at InStockTrades.com. Check out all the deals they are waiting for you at InStockTrades.com. A few months ago, Chris Roberson made news when he announced that he was going to be leaving DC and Vertigo Comics to strike out on his own. We talked to him and Allison Baker now about the debut of his new line of digital comics, Monkey Brain, including his own title, Edison Rex. We'll get the details from Chris and Allison right now on Word Balloon. Chris Roberson, Allison Baker, welcome back to Word Balloon. Good to talk to both of you.
Glad to be here.
So tell me about this this big new business venture as we see the Monkey Brain imprint move to comics. What was the impetus for this at this time?
We like comics. I like making and reading comics. And this seemed a good way of doing both those things. That's the simple answer. The slightly more complicated answer is that, we owned a publishing company that, Monkey Brain Books.
Absolutely.
That did, you know, books without pictures. And that was before I broke into the comics business. And since breaking into comics, we've been trying to figure out a way to do comics, ourselves. And, digital seemed a good way of doing that because the main hurdle that we couldn't jump over were just the startup cost and the maintenance cost of printing and distributing either individual issues or collections. It was prohibitive to start a thing up. But digital, because it cuts out the printing cost and the distribution, the warehouse and all that stuff, you basically just have to cover the nut of the people making the thing. And then, you know, with the goal in mind ultimately of haven't produced enough pages and issues that you can do a collection and then actually, you know, sell that through stores. So we spent a couple of years trying to figure out how to put this together with an eye towards doing my own comics. And then once we built this system, we realized that it could work for anybody. That we had created through Comixology a conduit for doing creator-owned comics that would work for any creator. And so we started approaching people that we knew that made comics and inviting them to bring projects to us. And the first titles coming out on July 4th is the first results of that.
Okay, and it's a group of titles, Aesop's Ark, Jay Torres, and Jennifer Meyer.
Yep.
Amelia Cole in the Unknown World, Adam Knave, DJ Kirkbide, and Nick Brookenshire. Bandette by Paul Tobin and Colleen Coover.
Yes.
Yourself and Dennis Culver, Edison Rex.
That is correct.
October Girl, Matthew Dow Smith.
That is also correct.
And finally, Wanderer by Kevin Church and Grace Allison.
Well, that the last one actually is coming out later in July.
Yeah, like the 17th is what we're scheduled to release that one at. But yeah, it is a July title.
Okay. The press release is a little bit confusing on that point, but it that's our fault. But yeah, so all six of those titles will be out in July, and possibly one or two others.
Yeah.
The first five of those will be out Wednesday, July 4th.
Are they 99-cent books, or what's the price point on these babies?
The majority of them are 99 cents. One of them, Amelia Cole, actually runs to 28 pages and is priced at $1.99.
Okay.
The rest of them are between, I think, 10 and 13 pages.
Actually, like, more like 13.
13 to 15 pages for the first installments and are 99 cents.
And obviously monthly releases then for each book?
It depends. The vast majority of these are projects, passion projects, personal projects that the creators are doing in addition to whatever other work they're doing. So the schedule really varies from project to project. Some of them are going to be even biweekly, some monthly, some maybe closer to bi-monthly or quarterly, just depending upon how quickly they can get done.
We also have, like, you know, a lot of the creators, we're pre-pressing, like, you know, issues 2 and 3 of a number of different titles. And so, you know, there's different ones are in different stages of development in the pipeline and whatnot. So,
and these are just our initial titles. We've got something like 30 additional projects in various stages of completion that are coming.
Crazy.
Yeah.
I'm curious because, as you say, Chris, I mean, you are an established novelist and were before you came to comics and stuff. Looking at the other creators that seem to be having, you know, immediate success with their creator-owned stuff, they spent, you know, I'm trying to remember how many years you've spent with, you know, DC, you know, doing stuff. And I just wonder, devil's advocate, do you feel that you've spent enough time, you know, working for one of the big two to, you know, test this out now from a comic standpoint?
You know, that's a good question. I think that a lot of the old rules don't really apply anymore. I think that, the way things, but again, the old rules probably only pertained, for relatively short time in the relatively recent past, because, you know, when I first became a really devoted, comic reader in the late 70s through mid 80s, there were any number of, instances of people who made their names and made their careers doing creator-owned stuff. You know, Bill Willingham or Matt Wagner,
sure,
or, you know, Scott McCloud, guys like that, that they started doing those things and were able to build a large enough readership to keep doing it. I think it's really only been, you know, through the 90s and since that this model of you build a big name doing things for DC or Marvel, and then go off to do your own stuff. I think probably that's largely inspired by the original founders of Image, because that's kind of the model that they followed.
Sure.
But yeah, I think certainly, you know, there's also economies of scale, because a readership that would be hovering around cancellation numbers in print, if the same number of people were paying for downloads digitally, for a digital original comic, that would be netting a decent income for the people making it. If you don't have to divide up more money to cover print cost and, you know, larger you know, distribution warehouse and larger corporate concerns and things like that.
How is the structure of this venture different from the novels you guys have produced?
It's pretty much the same. We spend a lot of time in Photoshop and InDesign at night.
Sure.
Which is awesome.
Yeah, I bet.
But, I mean, I think it's a faster schedule, for sure.
Okay, okay.
You know, as far as royalty payments and whatnot go, but, you know, I think that it's something that we've been doing for a long time, and the infrastructure was really already built, you know, as far as the corporate structure and the accounting structure and me figuring out how to pay royalties and whatnot, and I've been doing that for a long time. So, you know, it's not that different.
But there's much more of an immediacy to what we're doing now, because certainly with the prose books we published, either the nonfiction or the fiction, there's a tremendously long lead time to get things solicited to retailers and get them stocked in the stores, in much the same way the direct market works. You have to, you know, months out. In the book world, it's 6 months to a year now that you have to announce titles. But because things are digital, there's no real solicitation. And so there's this really satisfying immediacy to, once something is finished, we can hand those files over to Comixology, and in a matter of, you know, at most a couple of weeks, people are going to be able to purchase and read that book without having to wait months and months and months for it to go through some sort of distribution channel.
Okay. Some of our other friends that are doing digital initiatives like Four Star offer kind of layers of art, some other kind of special effects beyond the 10 or to 15 pages of story that, you know, you're going to provide for 99 cents. Is there any other bonus features that come along with the stories?
There's definitely been talk about that. There won't be in these first launch title, in the first issues that go up. But okay. There's been a lot of discussion about additional bonus things that could be added in subsequent installments. Really, we've been just so under the gun to get the whole machine up and moving for the first titles that we didn't have a lot of time to worry about bells and whistles. We will be soldering on bells and whistles in subsequent installments.
And just to look back, you know, with what was going on with DC and your impetus to leave, did that hurry along this process?
Not as such. I mean, you know, there wasn't a direct one-to-one relation. It's not that, you know,
okay,
something happened and inspired this. If anything, there was kind of the things that inspired me to want to do my own comics imprint and to have a greater degree of control. A lot of those same things were observations that I had made that fed into ultimately my decision to part ways with DC. But it's really that both were inspired by the same observations rather than that one decision informed the other.
We've been working on this for
about 2 years,
a couple of years now. And have really been, and it's been in its final stages for, you know, since December, January, this year. So
yeah, but we started putting this together before I started writing Superman. And we've had this structure in place and have started putting titles together since, what, 4 months before Watchmen was announced. So yeah, it was before the final proverbial camel straw that broke my back.
And what, you know, do you mind amplifying from your statement what it was about before Watchmen? Because I know you two also have a business relationship with Alan Moore that I think has been a very fun one that fans have enjoyed through Jess Nevin's annotations of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and help me beyond the other ones. Has it just been the volumes of League, or were there other titles that Jess was doing?
Jess also did the Encyclopedia Fantastic Victoriana for us, but we published three companions to the various League of Extraordinary Gentlemen starting in 2003.
Okay.
June 2003 was the first one. And we did Heroes and Monsters and Blazing World and Impossible Territories. So covering the two that came out through Wildstorm, and then the Black Dossier was the third one that was annotated.
Gotcha.
Basically any time there was any sort of industry kerfuffle involving Alan, we tended to get our backs up because we've had, you know, some personal and professional dealings with the man. And he is endlessly patient, incredibly gracious, and generous with his time and efforts, just like the nicest, most gentlemanly person imaginable. He's like just the friendly British uncle you didn't know you had. And, you know, over the course of, you know, 3 decades or so of his run-ins and conflicts with various publishers, there's been this kind of perpetual and increasing over time characterization of him as some crazy old crank, you know, that he's just off, you know, sitting in a basement somewhere, firing off angry letters that have no relation to reality, and he's just nuts and angry. And the nothing could be farther from the truth. And in fact, you know, like, he is, you know, aggrieved about a number of things, but he came by that honestly. And so when this most recent wave of I never saw the Watchmen film, for example.
Okay.
I didn't go out and campaign against it. I just didn't feel like I should support it with my time or dollars. But it wasn't until the prequels were announced that I felt like I'd really reached a point that I couldn't handle it anymore. Because, you know, as Ed Brubaker's pointed out, when Watchmen was released, or was first announced really in the mid-80s, it was touted by DC as a new step forward in creators' rights. This was an instance where, you know, the creators would be taken care of and their rights looked after and everybody would benefit. And that clearly there was this permutation of the way the rights had been spelled out that honestly I don't think anybody at the time had anticipated. That the book would stay in print into perpetuity, and therefore that DC would control those rights. And I would never argue that DC should let the thing lapse out of print just so the rights go back to Alan and Dave. And I think that's the way it works. It's a business, you know, everybody's
right.
But it's exploiting subsidiary rights that no one at the time had imagined anybody would exploit. Like making prequels over the objections of one of the co-creators. And over, to be frank, the fairly tepid endorsement of the other co-creator.
Yes, indeed. You're talking about Dave Gibbons, obviously, as you say, tepid statement that kind of is neutral. I just talked to Dave about a month ago about that, and I understand that point of view. And I appreciate that you also see – and I'm not going to cozy up to any corporation, but just, you know, in terms of business, you know, the analogy I keep making is no one was expecting Gone with the Wind, but that's what they got. And I can kind of see the publisher going, we're not going to let Gone with the Wind go out of print.
Yeah.
And again, it's a question of and not being in the room and not hearing what, if anything, is being done to address these subsidiary platforms and the possibilities of, you know, remaking, you know, things into different forms, including prequels and stuff like that. I don't know. I mean, I'm not in the room. So, yeah, I defer to the creators themselves and look forward to any spelling out that Dave or Alan, I think, give in the future. And then I understand your sense of loyalty to them as well. And I go back to, and again, not to say that it's right, but obviously, you know, Steve, you know, Spider-Man didn't stop when Steve Ditko and Stan stopped doing it. I'm just trying to wrap my head around that as a reader.
Well, I think you're quite right. And the difference is that Watchmen was created under different circumstances. And I think Alan himself has said in interviews that he doesn't begrudge anyone making use, for example, of John Constantine. He says that, you know, that's a character that he created for a book he was doing on a work-for-hire basis. That belongs to the company. You know, they can do with that character what they will. You know, Watchmen and V for Vendetta, for that matter, were books that were began under different circumstances. I mean, like Alan doesn't object to anybody doing anything with the America's Best Comics characters, with Tom Strong or Promethea or whatever. Doesn't object to the existence of Hellblazer or any of those things. It's like, okay. Watchmen was a book that Alan and Dave were going to own once DC got done publishing it. And that's still the case. As far as anyone knows, no one has really seen the contract that doesn't work at DC or is not Alan and Dave, so far as I know. But no one has ever contradicted in the last 25 years, however long it's been, 26 years, that all rights will revert to them when the work goes out of print. That's not the case with the work for hire book. So, like, if Marvel stopped publishing Spider-Man tomorrow, there would be at no point on the calendar that any rights would revert to Steve Ditko.
Agreed. Okay, there you go. No, please, Allison. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, she's wrong. I was just asking you about, like, well, what about the?
Well, that's a whole other mess.
That's a whole other thing.
What about what? We couldn't hear you.
So what she's asking about is that there's a provision in U.S. copyright law, which is the one that the various estates have tried to exercise recently, like Joe Simon and the Siegels, where even work for hire creations can, at a certain amount of years later, the creators can petition to have those rights revert. But that's right. Way in the future.
And currently, am I right, with the Sonny Bono Act, it's like 90 years now.
It's, yeah, something like that.
I don't know if Watchmen falls under the 76 Act or not. I'm assuming that was the last time it was addressed. And this is something that listeners can look up and figure out. And good luck. Yeah. Because, no. And yeah, no kidding. No, and as you say, I mean, I understand that. And honestly, I appreciate you kind of explaining the subtle differences there, because I think a lot of people do look at it at Constantine and Watchmen and V for Vendetta as no different, you know, or scenarios, including America's Best Comics too. So no, that's good information. All right, well, let's move on to what Monkey Brain is bringing out now.
Okay,
and talk about some of these series in general and stuff. I'm going to start with yours, Edison Rex. You and Dennis Culver. I like it because it has both a pulp feel. It's almost well, I want you to explain it, and I'll give my impressions in terms of what you're giving us in Edison Rex.
The original idea was a notion that I've been playing around with for a couple of years now, and had never figured out quite how to crack it. And so I had the character name and the basic idea, and then kind of backburned it. And I at Emerald City this year, I was talking to Dennis Culver, who is a fantastic artist whose work everyone will know very shortly, if they don't know it already. And we were talking about we should do something together. And I said, well, what do you want to do? And he gave me a very brief, you know, it's this meets this kind of formulation elevator pitch. And I said, as a matter of fact, I've already written that, and here it is, if you want to draw it. And the idea evolved very quickly from there. So the high concept, not spoiling the end, but setting up the beginning, is that the world's smartest man, who's a criminal genius and is the arch nemesis of the world's greatest hero, has devoted his entire adult life to defeating his nemesis, the world's greatest hero, on the grounds that he believes that the world's greatest hero is a menace and is bad for humanity, while at the same time, you know, building death rays and whatnot to defeat the hero. And in this first installment, he manages to defeat the hero. He's accomplished the thing he set out to do. And he has to figure out what to do with the rest of his life, and also what to do now in a world that doesn't have a world's greatest hero protecting him. and that's where the series begins, and hilarity ensues.
Understood. And it seems like it's you tell me, and I'll edit if this teases too much. But it almost seems like there's a bit of Lex Luthor, but also a bit of Doc Savage in Edison Rex.
I don't think that would be an unfair assessment.
Okay, I like it.
You, sir, are a very careful and attentive reader, is all I'm saying.
I think they're all very interesting concepts. Aesop's arc is very interesting. Jay Torres and Jennifer Meyer. Mm-hmm. There's like kind of an Animal Farm feel.
Yeah.
There's some interesting ideas going on with animals, but with a lot of human ideas and emotions happening as well.
And I think, Allison, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think it's been specified in the text yet, but I think it's set on Noah's Ark, right?
Yeah, they're on an ark.
So it's essentially Noah's Ark, and it is animal fables. It is, you know,
yeah,
animal moral fables, you know, set in the context of animals on Noah's Ark interacting with each other. And when they first mentioned the idea to us, we were like, that sounds crazy and awesome. Go do that. And
yeah.
Yeah.
And she is just, you know, I think she's not really well known in the comics field. She's more of an illustrator, but I think her art is just a fantastic.
Beautiful art, absolutely, and very unconventional, which I think is great for digital, and also it clearly fits the project as well because it gives it that storyboard look.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Or storybook look, excuse me.
Yeah.
And I love Bandit by Tobin and Coover. It's the usual kind of happy, kind of almost sprite kind of stuff that we expect from Colleen, and always happy when the two of them work together. So I'm glad that you were able to get them to contribute to this as well.
Well, I think Bandit, and then later October Girl, and Edison Rex for that matter, represent really what I think is best in what Monkey Brain is trying to accomplish. Not that the other two are bad, don't get me wrong. I'm saying that the one aspect of creators who maybe are well-known for doing other things getting to do exactly the book they want to do, that maybe market constraints or practical realities might have prevented them from doing. Because Bandette, as we had lunch with Paul and Colleen yesterday, and Paul described it as, you know, French kids comics, not as they are, but as he thinks they are, as he imagines them to be or wants them to be. And, you know, in much the same way, like, you know.
Or what you remember.
Yeah, what you remember.
But what you remember is not necessarily what it is. You know, yeah. Like everybody's like had that like TV show or like book they read or comic they read that like they remember being like the best thing ever. And then they go back and read it as an adult. And it's kind of like disappointing because you like your brain kind of like fills in a lot of blanks with your memory. And so basically that's what's happened.
Yeah. I mean, Edison Rex is basically grows out of my childhood reading of Bronze Age Shapiro comics and old pulp novel reprints, and then trying, you know, thinking about what I would do if I was in charge. So,
I like it. And also Amelia Cole in The Unknown World. I think Buffy fans would find something to grab onto here.
Yeah.
Tim Hunter fans would find something to grab on. I mean, there's definitely this cross between magic in a different way that we've seen before. And somebody that's fighting using it, and then you know coming up against the type of obstacles you would find in a magic filled world.
Yeah.
But a modern world, and a parallel world. Apparently, you've got the regular world and the unknown world, as the title suggests.
That's two worlds for the price of one.
Very nice, excellent. Adam Knave, DJ Kirkbide, and Nick Brookenshire. Doing Amelia Cole and The Unknown World. No, I think there's interesting stuff here. Now, tell me about October Girl.
October Girl. So Matthew Dow Smith is someone who I first came to know as an artist beginning in the late 90s. I mean, he's probably been best known in recent years for doing a lot of the art on IDW's Doctor Who comics. But before that, he had done a couple of issues of James Robinson's Starman. He did, in fact, the first appearance of Lobster Johnson in Mike Mignola's Hellboy books. But, you know, got to know Matthew on the internet because he was a big fan of some of the novels and collections that Monkey Brain Books had published, in particular the works of a British writer named Kim Newman. He was just a big fan of Kim Newman's. And just in talking about our mutual admiration for Newman stuff, I discovered that Matthew was also a fantastic writer and had started writing a bunch of different projects and actually wanted to be a writer originally before he broke into comics. And once we started talking about what we were doing digitally, we said, well, you know, we would love to see anything you wanted to do. If you wanted to write something of your own and draw it, that would be great. And he went away and didn't tell us anything and then came back and just handed us October Girl, which is this idea that he's been working on for a long time, apparently. And I think it's fantastic. It's kind of a slightly darker, I guess you'd call it an urban fantasy, contemporary fantasy, about a girl whose childhood imaginary friend comes back and then strange things happen.
Okay. That's fine. And Wander is, do I have a preview of Wander? I don't think I do.
No,
you don't have that yet.
Well, you want to give us the 10-cent pitch on Wander? Or?
We don't have the preview pages on Wander either.
Oh, okay. No worries. I'm looking at the, you know, I'm reading from the press release.
It's coming. We have a cover, and we know what they told us it was going to be. But Kevin Church, that feckless bastard, has not sent us any pages yet. So
fair enough.
Yeah, it's what for, I don't want to spoil it yet because I think what he told me was the high concept is billing to, and I'm reluctant to share that for fear that that's going to spoil something in these early chapters. So it looks to be good. Is all I'll say.
Okay. Well, and we've got five to start with then on the fourth,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's cool. Okay.
Shabby, huh?
Not shabby at all. No, well done. No, I'm really excited, guys, honestly. And I do think that they are exciting ideas, fresh ideas. We're recording this before your press conference, so I don't know how much you're going to release in terms of preview pages to the comics blogs and, you know, the different news outlets and stuff.
I wasn't correct if I'm wrong, but I think what
you got was what we're going to release.
Yeah. So,
okay.
So the rest, the world will see those preview pages at some point in the next couple of days. So.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
All right, excellent. I mean, yeah, so people will be able to look online and check out some of the previews.
And our website actually will be live as well.
By shortly after the time of the conference call, monkeybraincomics.com will be live with all those preview pages and the press release and everything as well.
Outstanding. So that as you're listening to this, that's already happening. So go over to monkeybraincomics.com, check out these five previews as well.
And what we realized last night, in kind of looking over everything and making sure everything was in place. It had not occurred to us before then, but for less than $6, you can purchase all of the launch titles on Wednesday.
Outstanding.
For less than $6. What's that? That's nothing.
That's less than two comics, for God's sake, in this market. Fantastic.
And you could look at it on your computer, on your phone, on your iPad, on your Kindle, on your Android, whatever.
On all those things.
And ultimately, you'll be able to buy these things in print. Because once, as I said, once there's enough issues out, we will be looking to do print collections. And we're already talking to a number of different publishers about partnering with them to get those out.
Fantastic.
If you don't want to wait for that, if you want to get on the ground floor of the awesomeness, less than $6 will get you in.
That's excellent, man. And I wanted to also acknowledge some of the other books that you've got out, old stuff and also current moving stuff. I wanted to acknowledge the Star Trek Legion of Superheroes miniseries because I saw the hardcover this week.
Yeah.
And I think that's a sweet collection, man. I love that cover.
Oh, I know. Isn't it gorgeous?
Fantastic. And, yeah, I mean, it's just a nice little Easter egg image that I think anybody can enjoy. Is that the regular cover or is that like a special variant? I saw it at Challengers.
That was – you talking about the Giffen cover?
Yeah, I guess it was a Giffen cover,
yeah.
Probably.
Yeah, that was.
With a bunch of little scenes all over the place?
Let's see. There might be more than one hardcover. The hardcover I saw had the Giffen cover that's like Spock behind some wreckage and the Legionnaires are coming towards him kind of thing.
Okay, you know, it almost looked like there were different, you know, different story things happening, but it was just this big giant image with all these characters.
It's a lot of crazy. All
I like it.
This is the insider information that I can share, is that cover got delayed because the first time that Keith drew it, he realized before turning it in that he'd accidentally drawn Namor and not Spock. So he had to go back and redo it.
That's awesome. Who else but Keith Giffen might notice that? That's fantastic.
Yeah. But it makes a lot of sense. I mean, you know.
There's a difference. Don't get me wrong.
Hey, if you put little wings on Spock's ankles, tell me you can tell a difference. You can't.
Right. Now, you know, it's tough. You know, well, he's got more of a Beatle haircut than than Namor's whatever the hell Bill Everett created years ago. God only knows. Yeah, it is kind of a widow's peak. That's hilarious, man. How's Revival going? Not Revival, pardon me. How's Memorial going?
Memorial? Well, you know, we've just wrapped up the first miniseries.
Yes.
I think it came out a week or two ago.
Hardcover comes out in August.
Hardcover in August. There will be an exciting, exciting announcement at San Diego about the next bit of Memorial. And I guess I could say that if you went to the IEW panel about digital projects, I'm already listed as being one of the panelists, and maybe we would talk about Memorial there. but that'll be next week. Next week, week after next.
Yes. Well, you know, we are talking about what's going on at San Diego. And also Monkey Brain has its own panel. Is that correct?
That's right. Friday at 7 in room 4 is the Monkey Brain Comics panel, moderated by Bill Willingham, who will also be doing a title for Monkey Brain in the not-too-distant future. And
outstanding.
Our panelists include Brandon Seifert of Witch Doctor, who's doing a book for us.
Wow, cool.
Joe Keating, who's currently writing Hell Yeah, and Corey for Image, who's doing a book for us.
DJ Kirk.
Outstanding.
DJ Kirk Bride of the aforementioned Amelia Cole.
Paul and Colleen.
Paul Tobin and Colleen Cooper of Bandette. Also in attendance will be Jennifer L. Meyer will be there.
Josh Williamson will be there.
Josh Williamson, who's also doing a book for Monkey Brain.
Matt Diggs,
who's drawing a book.
Chris Sims,
who's writing a book.
Outstanding.
I don't know.
There's a lot of them. We got a lot of people.
that's great, guys.
I will say that I have a couple of other projects at other places in the works. One of them is going to be announced on Saturday at San Diego at a panel for the publisher who's publishing it.
All right. Interesting.
Whose name might start with I.
Interesting. I think we can do the math. All right. I like it. This is true. That's a good point. There are two choices. Oh, my. I just realized that. Shame on me. I was like, all right, that's a foregone conclusion, but not necessarily. Very good. And Allison, I know you were just the subject of it, but I have to mention it on the air because I said it when I had J.K. Woodward on talking about the Star Trek Doctor Who crossover, how much I loved his, and as we're talking briefly about the Legion book, how much I enjoyed his depiction of you as Saturn Girl.
Yes. Yeah.
That's awesome. That's fantastic.
That's all Chris Sims' fault.
It's funny. Yeah. It was great. It clearly looks both like Saturn Girl and you. I think it's excellent.
I know. It's crazy.
That's funny because what happened was when the cover for Star Trek Legion number 1 came out by Phil Jimenez, Chris Sims was convinced that Jimenez had based Saturn Girl on Allison, even though Jimenez didn't meet Allison until shortly after he turned that cover in.
Yeah.
And so then that became just a thing, a recurring in-joke. That then became literal reality when J.K. Woodward did base Saturn Girl on Allison, bringing it full circle.
Yeah.
So
we also make as far as comics come out this week, iZombie 27 comes out this week.
And final issue.
No. One more.
No.
28's the final.
The penultimate issue.
Ah, the penultimate. Yeah, the fine word, penultimate.
But there are some cameos.
We don't know yet.
By somebody.
We don't know yet.
Did they scratch that?
They don't show anything. No,
we
did.
No.
Everything is on the record with us, John. Like nothing.
You're good guys. All right, I appreciate that. Well, you know. that's fantastic. Very good. What'd you say, Allison?
Allison's trying to think what else we can talk about.
I'll let her think.
Yeah, most of these people, one of the things we can't talk about until really the fall, the other thing won't come out until after San Diego.
Yeah, I have one work-for-hire project that is insane that will probably be announced in August. And it's yet more proof that I'm simply sitting in a corner, delusional, imagining my entire life because it's just ridiculous. And then there's another creator-owned book that will be announced probably in the fall.
Yeah.
At another publisher. So I think that's it.
Yeah.
And also, you guys were kind enough to give me your latest sci-fi novel as well, which is some good space opera happening. I want to give you guys a chance to plug that book.
Oh, sure. It's called Further Beyond the Threshold, and it's the wacky adventures of a guy from the near future who falls asleep and wakes up in the very far future has lots of adventures and flies in spaceships, and there's a talking chimpanzee in a fez. And a bipedal female orca. And I don't know. Hilarity ensues.
That's your go-to.
Hilarity ensues is my...
Hilarity ensues, but that's all right. We know the short end. That's all right. Yeah. No, that's good. No, you guys, honestly, Chris, you've always had really good high-concept ideas, and it's been fun seeing you bring those to... You know, DC and Vertigo when, you know, you were doing Cinderella and you know, things for Fables. And then also, like I said, you had that stupid, thankless job of taking absolutely nothing for being left, you know, mid-bore on the Superman Monthly title, and you cracked that title on the ass, and all of a sudden it was jumping and moving again, and it was like, oh, I remember when Superman used to be fun. Thanks, Chris. Come on, that was a mess, and you righted that ship. I don't know how many people dropped off, but the people that hung on read a really fun story.
Well, thank you, man. Like, that was a lot of fun to do, and that, you know, that was a job that I'd wanted to do since I was 6 years old. And I would probably say, in context of what we've been talking about so far, that anybody that enjoyed my work on Superman might find things that they enjoyed in Edison Rex, because Edison Rex comes from a similar place in terms of, like, the story ideas and whatnot. My inspiration for him.
That's cool. It'll be interesting to see what the storyline vacuum leads to wherever the story will go.
But I will say that when Super Squirrel is drawn, whatever variant he's drawn in Edison Rex, he won't be taken off the page.
Well, now you have to explain that. Because,
yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know about the Super Squirrel. By all means.
So in issue 7, Superman 708, one of the great tragedies of my brief run on Superman is that Eddie Barrows had drawn and had been inked that Super Squirrel from Captain Carrot and His Amazing Zoo Crew was one of the members of the Superman squad in the Fortress of Solidarity. He was drawn on panel and looked great. And it got to the higher-ups. I believe it was Dan, Mr. Didio, who declared that that was too silly and there could not be superpowered funny animals in a DC title. And he was excised. They took him off the page.
You had no problem with the Super Titano or Titano.
Apparently, super giant monkeys are okay. Super super bipedal anthropomorphized squirrels is a bridge too far.
Well, I guess so. I'm sorry to hear that. Yeah. That's.
It was a great looking page too.
Aw, man. Well, that's all right. Well, you know, as always, I think this is a very exciting venture for you guys, and I'm interested to see what happens. I'm going to be part of, as we're recording this, Chris is going to address some of the other comic journalists tomorrow, or both of you are, I guess,
yeah,
at this press conference. So I'll be interested to hear what comes out there as well. And yeah, look forward to the panel and see what Monkey Brain has to offer as they step into the digital comics world. I think that's fantastic, man. I think you really do have some really strong concepts that you're starting with. You certainly have a lot of talented people that you're working with, so that's cool. Is it easier to – have you guys been making more friends since you've made the jump now to Portland? You went from Texas to Portland within a matter of months. I imagine you're still unpacking.
We actually just unpacked the last of the boxes last week.
Most.
Oh, there you go.
Don't denigrate our accomplishment, man. Like, there's – a couple of boxes hidden in a closet. Those will count.
I will just say that, like, we decided to move across the country and launch a completely new comics imprint in the same month.
Yeah.
So, cool. Pretty cool.
Yeah.
Very ambitious.
I was kind of like, oh, okay.
But you know, we've met a few people since we got here, but really it was the dozens of people we already knew here through comic conventions and elsewhere that was what drew us here in the first place. So we landed in Portland about a month ago with an extensive social circle already in place. So
that's excellent.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. And that was after Stumptown, so you weren't able to go to Stumptown this year, I'm guessing.
Was not, no. So next will be okay. My first Stumptown.
That's cool. I'm hoping next year's my first Stumptown, too. I love that community out there, and you guys are just two more reasons to make the point of making a Portland trip. So
now you have to.
It's true. It's totally true, man. No, this is great, guys, honestly. Congratulations.
Thanks.
And certainly, I mean – this is the year that everyone is kind of making this shift, and I think it's great, and I really think that it's only going to make for a more interesting comics market, and I think the key is too that you're choosing these, you know, diverse kind of ideas that the big two wouldn't necessarily have time for or space for.
Yeah.
So I think that's I think that's the key. So yeah, I mean, I don't know what other avenues are you going to, you know, beyond talking to me and talking to the comics blogosphere, how else are you getting the word out?
Well, one of the things that we're doing a little differently is we've looked at the way that things are sold digitally, not outside of comics, the way things are announced.
Okay.
And, like, for example, if there's a new game for your iPhone or some new application that's available through the App Store or whatever the case may be, that they don't start teasing it 6 months out with, single confusing images or interviews with the creators or whatnot. They wait until the thing is available to get right then.
Right.
And that's when they say, hey, world, there's this great thing you can go get right this second. Go check it out. So one of the things that we're doing is waiting until there's stuff to show people and then going to the world outside of the comics field, the comics market, to say, hey, here's these there's new comics that you can check out. And that's something that we'll continue to do as new things come out. We won't be soliciting in advance, but we'll be doing big announcements as things are available. And so, you know, one of the steps will be to go to friends that we have in the media outside comics, you know, okay. newspapers and websites and whatnot. There are still newspapers. I've seen them.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That's why we've held off on really going into what we're doing until the week that the books are released, because I really wanted the push to be on people being available, people being able to buy the books while people are talking about them.
Absolutely.
I felt like it was kind of pointless to just because we would rather, because we would like to talk about it in public. I mean, it's been difficult
for 6 months
six
now.
That we've not been able to say anything about what we're doing. You
bursting
know?
At the seams, wanting to show people the cool art that was coming in. But we realized that it really made more sense to wait until we could sell it to them.
Yeah.
To then start telling them about it.
Absolutely. No, and that's the thing. I think you've got five issues here, or, you know, good previews of five issues that I think kind of explains your product. And as you say, will satisfy that instant demand of, all right, what are they talking about? Let me see it now.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah, no, that's key to digital. So that's fantastic. Nice going, guys. Well done.
Thanks.
Well, I guess the next steps would be, I'll certainly, as we're recording, be listening and hearing what you guys have to say at the press conference tomorrow at your panel in San Diego. And, you know, as new things come up, obviously keep me informed, and maybe we'll talk to some of your creators and stuff and talk about some of these Monkey Brain books.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic. Great. I mean, you know, they're all happy to talk. I mean, I feel sorry for them because they've all, like, you can't talk about it at all. And they're all just dying to, like, you know, share.
We've had them under this embargo for months. So I'm sure they would love to come on and talk at length about their progress.
Excellent, man. Very cool. Well, there you go. So go to monkeybraincomics.com. Is that where it is?
That's
or monkeybrain.com?
And there'll be information on all the creators, including the letters and the colorists. And, you know, we feel it's very important that, you know, everybody get recognition for the work they've done. Because, you know, it's really a team effort, and we wouldn't be able to do the work that we've done without all these amazing people.
Fantastic. No, that's great. And continued success. And I think this is a great move, but I know you guys are old-time publishers as far as the, you know, the prose world goes, and certainly you've been indoctrinated in the world of comics, so I think you're armed for the battle. So good luck as this unfolds. I think that's terrific. Way to go.
Thanks. We'll try our best.
Okay. I think we're okay.
Yeah, that sounds good, man.
All right, excellent, man. Yeah, I'll put these two pieces together, and this is a fine little thing. I think I'm going to have you with the producers who are making that public television comics documentary.
Okay.
Because I'm almost, I was thinking about releasing a couple episodes while the show's going on and calling it unconventional coverage. And, you know, that way, like, I'll point out the fact that obviously I like the fact that you guys are slipping in and doing this before the tidal wave of check this out at San Diego, or, you know, all the pre-announcements that are coming out. So you guys, smart.
Yeah, we talked about that a lot.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah.
What were you going to say, Allison?
Oh, and I think that we're going to get quite a large amount of coverage tomorrow. So
I think you're right.
That's
absolutely.
Because everybody's holding their news for San Diego. So.
Exactly. No, I got something from Dark Horse that I think they are going to start doing pre-announcements and stuff. But no, I think you guys, especially scheduling this thing tomorrow and everything, good thinking.
I couldn't not do Independence Day. It just, like, all fell together, like, too perfectly.
And no, and you're right about that. And yes, I didn't. I didn't mention that on the interview.
No, it's fine, but it's just funny because, like, that's literally, like, I looked at the calendar and I had the concept, and I looked at the calendar and I was like, oh my God, July 4th is a Wednesday.
It's fantastic.
Wednesday before San Diego. How perfect is that? So
absolutely. What are you guys getting in?
Wednesday.
I get in Tuesday, but you get in Wednesday.
Wow. Okay. Because, yeah, I'm coming in Wednesday morning as well. And yeah, I'm leaving Saturday night.
Okay. We'll definitely see you, if nothing else, you on Friday, but I'm sure.
Yes.
So we'll be drinking the Bayfront Hilton again, which is where we saw you last, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, I know you guys hung with Art and Franco out there. I hung with Francesco Francavilla and
Lisa.
And his wife out there, exactly, and Lisa and Chris Burnham. But
on the balcony.
Yes, sir. That's on that balcony. No, that's the best. They have the best.
Liz will be at our party, too, so.
Yeah, that's so you're going to do the party, and then you're going to come plow to your panel.
Yeah.
Stagger to our panel.
Exactly. No, this is really great, honestly.
Yeah.
No, that's cool. And I love that Hilton because they serve the Republic of Tea bottled iced tea.
Ah.
It is seriously, I know this sounds ridiculous. It is the best iced tea I've ever had. It's $5 a bottle, and I find it worth $5 a bottle. It is the greatest iced tea.
I like their rum.
You can come and drink after in it with us. Our food and drinks will be free. So.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
I finally got that nailed down today. I was like, yay. I've been working on that for 4 months. 4 months.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, no, that's awesome. I appreciate it. I truly thank you for inviting me. That's fantastic. So, no, I'm happy to do this, guys, honestly. And I thought it sounded good, and I'll just tighten it up a little bit. But I'll probably put it out, if not Tuesday, definitely Thursday.
Okay,
oh,
great.
Perfect. Yeah, just let me know when it's up, and we'll link to it on the website.
Fantastic.
Okay.
All right, well, I appreciate it. You guys be well.
Thanks.
And we'll see you in about 10 days.
Sounds good, man.
All right, take care, guys.
Thanks.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Nice conversation with Allison Baker and Chris Robertson. We wish them luck on Monkey Brain Comics. They don't need luck. It's great stuff. If you haven't gone to monkeybraincomics.com or Comixology to pick up those first 5 titles, you should definitely check them out. Again, go to monkeybraincomics.com for the preview of all those 5 titles that have already debuted. And I think you're going to find something that you like. Now we turn to the world of documentary film. Larry Maslon and Michael Kantor are experienced guys. They've done a couple of my favorite PBS documentaries in recent years. They're on a brand new project, a great look at the history of comics. We get the details as they stand right now from Larry and Michael on this portion of Word Balloon. Larry Maslon, Michael Kantor, welcome to Word Balloon. It's a pleasure to talk to you guys.
Great to be
Thank
here.
You.
And looking forward to The Never-Ending Battle, a documentary you guys are producing for public television. I saw the teaser panel at last year's New York Comic-Con and have been tracking the progress on the show. First of all, let's start with when it might air. You guys tell me when it will be airing soon, hopefully.
We are working with PBS to determine exactly when, but right now it's looking good for the fall of 2013. So... we hope that we'll be able to preview a full episode or more of the 3-part series at the San Diego Comic-Con, not this year, but next year.
Very cool. And judging by both of your bodies of work, both together and separately, I see you guys are pop culture guys. You worked on the Broadway documentary and book, and also the Make 'em Laugh comedy documentary and book. What led you guys to comic books?
Well, I guess comic books is what we were reading in between doing Broadway and Make 'em Laugh. I've always been a comic book fan since kind of like day one. And I grew up in the 70s when there was very little history about comic books. There was Jules Pfeiffer's book.
Mm-hmm.
There was Steranko's 2-volume book. There was a wonderful book by a guy named Dick Lupoff called All in Color for a Dime. And then, you know, for me, I went to college in 77, and, you know, I wouldn't say I put away childish things, but I had other priorities. And then when I got reinterested in comics, I guess in the late 90s, just sort of for fun, I was stunned at how many books and how fandom had really progressed and gone mainstream. So it seemed like a logical thing to talk to. I was thrilled when Michael brought it up as a subject, and Michael can talk about how he was led to it.
Yeah, essentially, the work that I've done for PBS, both on my own and working under what I call the Ken Burns umbrella, which is American history, has been seeking to try and answer this impossible question, which is, who are we as Americans? What makes us American? What do we have in common? How did our culture get this way? What are the influences? And Larry and I did the Broadway, the American Musical, which was a series looking at how popular music across the 20th century served as a kind of barometer for American culture. And then we did another series called Make 'em Laugh, which looked at how comedy could likewise reflect and mirror what was going on in the culture. And it just seemed natural that we take on superheroes who in so many ways have reflected how we as a country, as a globe, have been feeling about our own failings and strengths and weaknesses and deep concerns in different eras. So it was actually Gerard Jones who wrote a great book called Men of Tomorrow, and I was interviewing him for the comedy series, and he said, you should really read this book. It might get you thinking about comic books and superheroes and so forth. And from that point forward, Larry and I have just worked to develop what will ultimately be the 3-hour documentary.
That's great. And I'm really glad you guys are doing this at this time. And I know from what video you guys showed too in New York, you were able to talk to a couple Golden Age people before they passed away. Unfortunately, we had two of them pass away this year, Joe Simon and Jerry Robinson. And am I correct? You got both of them, didn't you?
Yeah, we always start with age and health considerations as best we can. And we began by interviewing Stan Lee, and then shortly thereafter were privileged to interview both Joe Simon and Jerry Robinson and Irwin Hasen.
Yes.
Among Carmine the other kind of,
very good,
you know,
yeah,
old timers. So, so far we've been welcomed with open arms by the community, and they have such great stories to tell. It's clear why they'd like to spend an hour with us talking about them.
What's the scope of the, from a historic standpoint, how many decades are you going to be covering? Are you going to go up to modern day, or are you sticking with a specific period?
I think one of the things that's always tricky is what history is very easy to determine in hindsight. You know, what's the Avengers movie and obviously the two that are on the deck for July, Spider-Man and Dark Knight. We're in the thick of it, boy. We're really at a time when comic book heroes seemingly couldn't be more popular. So I think we definitely want to access that recent phenomenon. What leads up to that, what the last 10 years are about, I think are a little sort of harder to determine. I mean, we'll include some of the highlights, of course. I mean, for me, something like Civil War was a highlight, mm-hmm. and the way comic book creators responded to 9/11, I think, is something that'll definitely be in the series. But we start, at the very beginning, certainly 1938 with Siegel and Shuster, and we even go a little further back, with Doc Savage and The Shadow and Flash Gordon and some of the antecedents. So mm-hmm. we hope to have a multi-decade overview.
Excellent. And I wonder for both of you, too. I'm glad you mentioned this last 10-year period, because while we've seen television and film success for superheroes, the comic book industry, since that 90s crash, has been in a very interesting place where I think creatively the guys responsible for the last 10 years of stories have put the movies and TV in the place where the mainstream can accept them. And they've really helped make the stories grow up and become more acceptable for a mainstream audience. But we're not seeing the millions that are consuming superheroes now are doing it more through TV and movies, as opposed to all of those decades when comics literally did have millions of readers, certainly on the newsstand.
Well, the flip side is one of the things we'll try to deal with is these sort of trajectories. I mean, I hate to pull the obvious comic book metaphor, but they're almost like an X, right? So you start with, as exactly you say, in the 40s, there were literally millions of readers monthly. I think there was a Captain Marvel at one point in 42 or 43. His combined titles, I think, were almost 2 million
yeah.
a month. And now, of course, if you're lucky, if you get 250,000, that's considered huge on a monthly title. But the flip side is, look at what the film and radio portrayals of superheroes were. Look how primitive those were in the 40s. So as the scale of what you can achieve in film and television have grown to really majestic heights, the actual readership of the comic books they're from has declined to a fraction of what they were in the 1940s.
Would you get into things like, you know, the digital age right now. I mean, this is something, again, really very conveniently, I think the last 10 years can be bookended from about 1999 to about 2010. And it really seems like this year and 2011 are the beginning of this new decade for comics. I don't know how much you can get into that on the documentary or not, or really if it's germane to your main thesis or not. But yeah, I mean, it really does seem like we're in this new decade and new era of where things might go digitally. Will the audience for comic readers, you know, grow in this new digital age as opposed to the decline we've seen in the last 20 years?
Yeah, I mean, I think the beginning and the end of any kind of documentary film is usually those are the areas you usually do last, and for good reason, because they're the toughest. And
sure.
So I think, you know, we had the pleasure of interviewing Joe Quesada. I think I'm very much looking forward to reaching out to Jeff Johns and Jim Lee and, you know, grappling both with all the different reboots of series as well as, you know, the recent kind of focus on gay characters.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just hard to say how those stories will play out right now, because we're still months and months away from, you know, making those tough choices of which stories to tell.
But The Shape is going to be 3 hours. You're definite on that?
Yes. And another thing we're trying to do, and again, we'll see how it plays out, but is to frame each hour around a particular hero. And obviously the first hour is going to be 1938 to 1954. And at the moment, that's framed by the creation of Superman to Superman appearing on television. And the second hour would be pretty much with the startup of Marvel Comics after the Comics Code Authority in 55, and take it to, and that would be about Spider-Man. That would be framed by Spider-Man. We're thinking perhaps of ending with Spider-Man's wedding at Shea Stadium, which was officiated by Stan Lee. And then the last episode, tentatively called Creatures of the Night, is actually framed by Batman with the Tim Burton film and the, no pun intended, the long shadow that Batman casts currently, not only in movies, but the sense of a darker superhero where maybe the distinction between hero and villain is blurred a lot with other characters such as Wolverine or Watchmen or Punisher and things like that. So I think we also want to try to show that another evolution, another exit, if you will, is an industry that really started having been run by adults for little kids, and now it's actually run by younger people for adults. It's a very much adult medium now, and in all aspects of the word adult. You know, it's obviously for mature audiences, but they're mature themes. I mean, I have a four-year-old son who's in love with Batman. You know, he has Batman sneakers and Batman shirt, but there's no way I could take him to see the Batman movie. So complicated situation, you know.
No, understood. And in fact, I think sometimes the adult fan gets frustrated at the products that are made specifically for kids, like Batman Brave and Bold. I saw adult Batman fans that didn't appreciate, you know, the good things about it currently with Ultimate Spider-Man. I think it's a big ratings hit for Disney XD. If you go to the comics blogosphere, I think you see a lot of adult fans that are disappointed that it's aimed for kids. But no, there's got to be entry points for them. And, you know, for the longest time, it was the comic that was the introduction product for children. And that obviously changed, too. And it sounds like, you know, you guys are certainly the way you're chopping through the hours and stuff like that are showing that change. That certainly for today's kids, it's really going to be cartoons and video games and movies that will be the introduction, you know, of these heroes to children as opposed to the comic books.
Totally. It's always our goal in these kind of series to hopefully appeal to both the kind of novice or uninitiated fan and the connoisseur, so that hopefully there are stories that are new to everyone, or there's material that people, it's very hard to come by to see, but also that it'll appeal to the 8-year-old or the 10-year-old who doesn't know anything about these stories.
Are DC and Marvel, given that they are, you know, such big parts now of the conglomerates that own them, more than ever, it really seems like Warner is very mindful of what DC, you know, the message that DC conveys to the public. Same goes with Disney and Marvel. Have you had easy access to, you know, the materials and also the people you want to talk to for this? You say you still have, I mean, that you hadn't spoken yet to Jeff Johns and Jim Lee. You know, is that difficult, you know, as an independent producer trying to talk to these corporate people?
So far, as I said before, they've welcomed us with open arms. We really haven't had any issues. They've made whatever they can make available to us. We showed them some of the work that we've done to date, and they seem very pleased. I think, you know, at some level, these kind of documentaries are a Valentine to the industry, and I think the industry welcomes that. And on another level, they just have much bigger fish to fry.
Sure.
So when we're doing our thing, you know, they're releasing, you know, new stories, new movies, new games, what have you, and that said, again, they've promised us access to whoever we need. So it's not, it's been really great so far. I can't point to any problems.
Well, that's good.
I think the involvement of PBS really has floated all bats, I like to say, in that it gives a real imprimatur, a kind of cultural hallmark to the comic book industry, I think, to be celebrated on PBS. And by the same token, hopefully it'll introduce a demographic that PBS would really enjoy having. So I think that's a really good mix. It's not the first thing you think of when you think of superheroes as PBS, but they certainly earned their right to take a seat at the table, as Michael said earlier, with Broadway or the West or baseball or all these things that PBS puts forth. I have to add a sort of amusing anecdote. The executives that certainly at DC and Warner Brothers and Marvel, but they've been really great in terms of getting excited about the project. And I was in Burbank at Warner Brothers talking to one of the executives, and he was just talking about all the requests he gets for Superman stuff. I mean, they're sort of in charge of deciding what, you know, what pajama bottoms Superman gets his logo on. And this fellow said that he kept getting sort of, not harassed, but a lot of phone calls from the Chamber of Commerce of the state of Ohio, because they wanted to put the Superman logo on their license plate. And because they wanted to be able to sell license plates that said Ohio, birthplace of Superman. And he said, you know, I really don't know what to do about that. I'm just, like, not into doing that. And I said, is that because, like, they'd be expensive to produce, like, birthplace of Superman license plates, Ohio? He said, no. He said, everybody knows the birthplace of Superman is Krypton.
Fantastic.
So, you know, the guys who are behind this, you know, they love the characters too, or they'd be in a different job. So, long way of saying, I think they really sense our affection and our desire to tell a full, unvarnished but not gossipy story about the whole industry.
The initial funding for the project actually came from two government entities, the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities. So I think everybody recognizes that culturally we share all these stories. This isn't some, you know, digging in somebody's closet for dirt kind of expose. This is our common cultural heritage, and it's really time to celebrate that and share it and explore it as best we can.
Oh, I understood. And honestly, I wasn't even thinking from any gossipy or salacious kind of information getting out, but more that they would rather produce their own documentary. In fact, DC just did their 75th anniversary history documentary, you know, and Marvel, I'm sure, probably next. Well, actually, I was going to say for 63, but maybe Fantastic Four started in 61. So we've already missed the 50th anniversary of the Marvel age, if you will. And that's where I was going. But I want to build on the anecdote you just gave, because what other revelations, and I don't want to spoil, because certainly we want to see the 3-hour show. But are there any other interesting interview moments that kind of gave you guys something that you didn't expect that you could share with us now?
I tell you one thing that knocks me out is, because it actually goes to your point about the DC Secret Origins documentary, is in-house documentaries are exactly that. We're the first people, as far as I know, to tell, as it were, both sides of the street. Not just both sides. I mean, there's also Fawcett and Quality and Archie and as we get on Dark Horse, stuff like that. So it's not just a DC Marvel story by any stretch of the imagination. But I remember interviewing Stan Lee down in Hollywood, because he lives around the corner in either Beverly Hills or Malibu. I don't remember. At any rate, and somehow we got on to the idea of death and what that does for a superhero and what kind of vengeful spirit that might create in an origin. And Stan started talking about how that worked for Batman. And Michael has edited that section really beautifully in the documentary. So, yeah, of course Stan's going to talk about Spidey and the Hulk, but to hear him talk about Batman is really, I don't know, it just sends shivers down my spine, because you realize, of course, all these guys read all each other's comics, and they have a lot to say about the entire mythology of comic book heroes.
That's cool, and I know, too, that certainly even, especially in the 60s, the two companies would get together informally and have lunch, and guys like Carmine Infantino and Stan Lee would get together and discuss, you know, what's going on in a friendly way. And I'm sure they kept their cards to their chest on certain things, but also to kind of share things and just, you know, it was a friendlier community. And I think it still is, the few times that they do get together on stage to kind of show, yeah, we're competing for the same dollars, but at the end, it is one big community and everyone is welcome.
My favorite story has to do with the interview we did with Joe Simon when he was thinking about working and creating Captain America. He said something to the effect of, you know, there's a lot of great ideas, and if you find a great idea, you can use it 8 times. It's okay. People will still enjoy it. And that strikes me as a sort of profound, simple but profound idea, that there's only so many great ideas in the world, whether in literature or film or painting or what have you. If you stumble across one and you do it your own way, you keep doing it. And I think that's something we're going to be looking for, how, you know, creators in different ages took a great idea and rebooted it or revamped it in some way.
Did you have a chance to ask any of them, especially the older creators? Because I'm always interested when I interview these guys, what they think of, you know, the way the superheroes are being handled today. And not just, you know, from it's too violent or whatever, but, you know, how engaged they might still be or aren't in terms of what's going on. And I just spoke to, like, Dave Gibbons, who co-created Watchmen. And, you know, it's great to see that Dave still reads comics and stuff. It seems like the generation behind ours, because it seems like we're all the same age, that those guys really did kind of drop their comics, didn't come back. And, you know, I find that interesting, given their contribution to the business, and that I would expect them to be a little bit more engaged with what's going on today, much like even a former filmmaker would seem to at least be aware of what was happening, you know, in a contemporary sense, as opposed to what was going on in their eras.
Well, I think you hit on an interesting paradox, which is you look at a guy like Roy Thomas, Len Wein, I guess Neil Adams, I may be getting the chronology wrong, but that's the first wave of guys who actually grew up reading, Steranko.
Yep.
Grew up reading comic books. You know, you got to feel sorry for Stan and Carmine and Irwin Hasen and Joe Kubert, because they didn't get to grow up reading comic books.
Yep.
They grew up reading comic strips, maybe a little bit, depending on their age, but really Roy and all those guys were actually, and maybe a little bit the next generation, born into a world that already celebrated comic books. So I think that's a huge difference. I think if you grew up with them and you love them, they're part of your DNA. I think the first wave of guys came across their desk. They were jobs they could take. It helped put money on the table. But I just don't think it was in their bloodstream. No pun in, you know, Joe Simon, pun intended. They didn't get the super serum when they were in the hospital, you know, being born. And a whole other several generations did.
Did you get that sense, too, both of you, that because listening to the interviews that Will Eisner did in his Shop Talk interviews. Dark Horse produced a trade paperback of that. But in a Will Eisner biography documentary that was released, they also included these audio interviews that Eisner did for his book. And you got that sense that a lot of these guys, you know, really did want to be comic strip artists, or, you know, really fine artists in the Saturday Evening Post or Collier's or some of these, you know, high profile magazines. And that was the ambition of these artists. And it really was slumming it, unfortunately, to be in comics, as much as we revere the Golden Age.
No, a lot of these guys in the interviews would say that they wouldn't use their real name, Carmine Infantino. And, you know, Stanley changed his name to Stanley because he planned to go off and write the great American novel, and he wanted to make sure that no one confused his work on comic books with you know, the high art. So it definitely early on was sort of the last possible choice for many of these guys.
Were you able to talk about that one crucial era of the early 50s when Dr. Wortham came out with Seduction of the Innocent? And again, you know, my audience is, you know, we're all hip to the history. It's funny. It's just like Ken Burns baseball, where we know the story and I think we know the broad strokes. But I think where productions like yours are going to be fun is the little kernels of, you know, information that I don't think we were privy to. And I wonder how much you were able to get from the old timers who were active during that blacklist period of comics, when, you know, the stories and the art really had to be dumbed down and you know, to the point where EC Comics was driven out of the business and Mad became a slick magazine as opposed to the original comic that it was.
Well, I think we're privileged in that we were able to talk to not only artists who worked at that time, and some people such as Stan Lee, who claimed to have met and debated Frederick Wortham, but also because of the type of project we're doing, we have people like Amy Nyberg and others who've written books, James Gilbert, about this era, and help us to sort of understand and contextualize those stories so that, you know, people can better, you know, from today's perspective, better understand them. No question, Frederick Wortham's a great character, and there's a little bit of footage of him and his incredibly broad German accent speaking about the subject, and we're keen to use it.
Very cool. And then also, as you mentioned, the today's success in with comics in other medium, it's fun to compare those flashes of comic crossovers that happened in the media of the 40s. Particularly and the 50s. You mentioned the Superman show, but you briefly mentioned radio. I think a lot of younger fans will be surprised at how many comic properties transcended the comic books and were successful entities in broadcast media and film.
Well, it's funny. I had to do some research for something else about a show. This is where my interests align or coincide. The 1966 musical, It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman.
Yeah.
Had a four-month run on Broadway and a fun show. They're going to do it at Encores next year from now or 9 months from now, so it'd be great to see that show again. But I read the original reviews, and it shocked me because back then, what, there were 6, 7, 8 New York newspapers rather than just one that covered the theater or three that covered the theater. And the guys were older guys. I mean, you could tell they were in their 50s and 60s. One critic said, you know, they're doing this musical about Superman, and, you know, I've actually never read anything of Superman. And then another, all the other critics referred to Superman as the comic strip hero, not the comic book hero.
Interesting.
And so it was a really kind of bracing thing to go, oh, you know, Superman was not, hadn't been around that long. I mean, he'd been around, what would that have been, 20-odd, 25 years, but it certainly wasn't the industry that it is today, and so it's important to recontextualize for even the most reasonably avid fan that even Superman, as titanic as he is, wasn't even the best-selling superhero back in the 40s. That was Captain Marvel, and why don't we see Captain Marvel these days, and why is it so difficult to get a good strip or a good book out of Captain Marvel? Well, we'll tell you why. There are sort of legal and conceptual reasons, And again, the first real appearance of a comic book hero in a visual medium is Captain Marvel. They couldn't work out a deal with DC to put Superman in a Saturday morning serial, so they went to the next best thing, which was Captain Marvel.
Yeah, and though, that's a great serial as well, and certainly when you put it in the period and stuff, the way they solve things like showing flight on live action film, it's pretty good. I'm a fan. So that's cool. And I was thinking, too, of the radio in particular. Things like the Archie Andrews radio show was, you know, over 10 years on network radio and had millions of listeners. So, right. You know, I mean, and Archie, I'm glad you guys are including Archie because I think Archie gets short shrift sometimes. And certainly the focus might be superheroes. But, you know, the brand of Archie and stuff and how it changed over the decades, I think, is part of the interesting story. And also that going back to Superman, the contributions that the radio show gave to the entire mythos. I mean, Kryptonite came from the radio show. Jimmy Olsen came from the radio show. Things like that.
That's exactly right.
All right. Yeah, I appreciate the agreement. I thought you might have a comment. But
no, those are exactly the kind of stories we're looking forward to telling.
Excellent, man. That's terrific.
You're stealing our thunder.
Oh, man. You see, I'm trying to, like, you know, join in with you guys. That's all. Honestly, it's exciting to see this. There have been other films that, you know, have kind of done portions of the history of comics. You know, the History Channel did one just a couple years ago as well, a 2-hour show. But and again, that was commercial 2 hours. I think it's great. And it really seems like you guys are reaching out to even more people than, you know, the handful that sometimes would make it on some of these other past comic documentaries. Adam West, part of the documentary?
Adam West, currently Adam West and Linda Carter are representing the actors who played superheroes, and we look forward to talking to others who've done that. He was terrific. We spoke to him out at his home in the West, and he has some interesting thoughts on what it all meant. I think at the time he didn't look at it the same way that he does now, but I think he feels strongly that that what he did was something that we should. I don't want to give away his stories, but he was good about talking about what the experience of playing a superhero meant to him. He said something to the effect of, "We all want to be stronger. We have a craving in human DNA to be more heroic, and we want respect as people, as human beings, not just as actors." And so he went on about that, and I think that'll bring an interesting angle to our discussion of what happens to Batman in the 60s.
And he did do some voiceover readings. Again, I won't tell you what, but it's a very seminal Batman dialogue. And to hear Adam West do it is pretty thrilling.
That's fantastic. And, you know, part of that 60s pop art era, interesting timing, because right now in Chicago at our Art Institute, there's the Roy Lichtenstein exhibit going on. I haven't gone yet. I'm going to be actually going in a couple of days after this recording. But I wonder if that will be part of your story as well, because Lichtenstein's, much like Andy Warhol, his homages to comic book art, it's kind of a dual-edged sword where I think there's a camp that appreciates what he did, and then there's a camp that feels that...
camp that appreciates what he did?
Well,
right.
Use that word intentionally.
Camp that considers it camp.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, you know, yeah, so that does that enter in the documentary as well?
Absolutely. I
Fantastic.
Mean, a lot of people say, well, what's this going to be? And I always sort of say my kind of flip remark is, if you're expecting Deathlok the Demolisher and Dr. Midnight in this documentary, I'm telling you right now, even though they're two of my favorites, they ain't going to be in the documentary. Just don't have the time. But I can promise you that after watching this, no mother would dare to throw away her kid's comic book collection after watching this documentary.
There you go.
We're really interested in how it reached American culture and how it infiltrated American culture. And again, you know, those... not only the Lichtenstein paintings, but Andy Warhol's first major job was as a window dresser at Von Witt Teller, and that's when he introduced his Superman and his Batman and his Dick Tracy paintings for the first time. And someone said to him, gee, you know, you have Superman in your thing, and what does that mean, Andy? What are you trying to say about American culture? And he said, I don't know. I really liked reading Superman when I grew up. And that's it, you
yeah.
know. So it's important to remember that again, the thing, all these artists, the comic books are in their DNA. So why wouldn't they be inspired? And then, and in a literary way, we were really lucky to get Michael Chabon, who's just tremendous on camera, you know, tying so many things culturally together as how it relates to the sort of the general American consciousness of how these characters entered our lives and what they say about us.
Very cool. No, I agree with you. When Chabon shows up on mainstream media, he is a good ambassador to comics and, you know, really, really is able to kind of put it in terms that I think anyone can understand and appreciate why we love it as much as we do. So very excited for Never Ending Battle, guys. Truly. And I don't want to miss anything. So if there's something that you guys want to mention, please, you know, share it with us now. Otherwise, because I appreciate the tightrope that you're walking with me, because I do have questions, but I also don't want to, you know, have anything spoiled either. So please, if there's something I'm missing, I'll give you a chance to talk
about it. I feel like we should come back, you know, 9 months or a year from now and bring you totally up to date. We're at an interesting moment where, you know, the trick is there are too many great stories, and we have to find the great representative stories that speak to more than, you know, the one particular character or situation. And that's what we're in the thick of right now.
Understood.
And I can sum up where we're going in exactly 3 words: to be continued.
Fantastic. Well, if it serves the documentary better as a preview podcast for it, I'm happy to do that. Or if you'd like to review after it starts airing, we can certainly arrange for another time. I'd love to talk to you guys more when you're finished and you can talk. I know it's like I'm talking to students that are halfway through an essay, so that's not fair. So I want to give you guys a chance to finish your assignment. But honestly, based on your previous work, very excited to see what the Never Ending Battle ends up being. 3 hours on PBS, looking at the fall of 2013 as of now. I will say to Larry and Michael again, thank you for your time and good luck, continued success, and really looking forward to what we get to see on the small screen next year.
Great.
Great pleasure.
Larry Maslon, Michael Cantor, good talking to those guys. Man, that sounds good. And we look forward to the progress on that production and look forward to talking to those guys again. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks again for listening. It's all brought to you today by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. Don't forget, you can get 42% off, sometimes more, the standard retail price. And when you order from InStockTrades.com and your order is $50 or more, you'll receive free shipping. Some of the deals going on this week: you can get Buffy the Vampire Slayer Season 9 trade paperback Free Fall for just $10.43. Fables Volume 17 trade paperback Inherit the Wind is just $8.99. Reaching back for a classic Hulk story, The Heart of Atom trade paperback, $14.99. Spider-Man Return of the Burglar, 40% off, $17.99. X-Men's Beauty and the Beast premium hardcover is also 40% off, just $17.99 at InStockTrades.com. Great deals waiting for you. All you have to do is go to their website, look for your favorite title, your favorite artist, your favorite publisher, your favorite writer. It's all waiting for you at prices you won't believe, InStockTrades.com. We are inching towards San Diego. Thanks to the League of Word Balloon listeners who responded, I kind of put out the SOS that with the convention coming up, if you ever thought about donating to Word Balloon and leaving a tip, it would be really appreciated at this time of year, really throughout the month of July, because it costs a lot to go to San Diego. I'm very happy to be there. Make sure you check out the podcast panel on Thursday night, Room 9, 6 p.m. I'm there with a bunch of my friends. I believe it's the 7th annual podcast panel. Hard to believe that it's been 7 years, but very happy to be representing Word Balloon in San Diego at that panel. If you're there, make sure you stop by and say hi. Otherwise, I'm going to be roaming the aisles just like you, looking for people and the best deals that I can find. So come by and say hello, and I'd be very happy to meet you, and thank you for listening to Word Balloon in person. So if you have any questions or comments about the show, you can reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com. Follow me on Facebook under my name, John Sundress. You can follow me at Twitter under John Word Balloon. And that'll do it. Until next time, thanks for listening. We're inching towards San Diego. I think we'll have time for one more show before the convention starts. So look forward in the days ahead. But until then, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2012.